State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee will come to order. Today is Monday. And we will first take up the approval of the minutes.
Mr. Chair, I so move.
Senator Vickerman moves the minutes from Wednesday, April 1st. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. We have a long agenda today, and we will start with Senator Bach, Senate File 1257. Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 1257 is the annual public finance bill. It was referred to the Tax Committee. I believe it was sent point the taxes first and was sent back down here. Senator Rest had one of the sections that she thought this committee should look at. So I didn't actually visit with her about that, so I'm not sure. Maybe council might know what part of the bill she wants this committee to go through. I believe, Mr. Chairman, it's Section 1.
Senator Bach, that is mail elections, so I would assume that that's correct.
I have a testifier from the Minnesota Institute for Public Finance here to speak to the provision. He serves on the committee that assembles this bill every year.
Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Steve Rossholt. That's R-O-S-H-O-L-T. I'm a lawyer and a member of the Minnesota Public Finance Institute. That's an organization of investment bankers, lawyers, trustees, and financial consultants who work with local governments on public finance matters.
Mr. Russell, could you get close to the mic or get it pointed directly at you to get a little bit better audio?
Section 1 of Senate File 1257 is a simple provision which eliminates the limitation on the number of questions that can be submitted in a mail ballot. Existing legislation requires that there can only be two questions submitted on a single at a single mail election. A number of school districts have found that that's difficult to work with because typically if there's a local bond election and a referendum levy election, that would be two questions, except that typically in the case of a bond election, it frequently happens that the school district will want to divide the question into two or more questions so that, for example, a school district might say, have one question, shall we issue bonds for a new high school? And another question would say, typically, if that question is approved, shall we issue bonds, additional bonds for an athletic facility or another school or some other purpose? So because of the way those questions are typically presented, it would be, and because school districts like to use the mail ballots, there's it would be makes a number of elections easier if more than two questions could be submitted.
Chairman, I believe that's the reason we're here.
Any questions from the committee? Seeing no questions, and I believe that is the only section that we are to look at here. Senator Day.
Mr. Chairman, also move 1257.
Senator Day moves Senate File 1257. Any questions? To be referred to the Taxes Committee. Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman of the committee.
Senate File 1481, Senator Cohen in the audience. Senator Tomasoni. Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen. Okay, we have Senator Torres Ray. Not doing so well here. Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, maybe we can do Senate File 1867 first. That would be a little shorter. The omnibus pension bill, is, as you can see from your packet, is quite a bit bigger. So
sounds like a winner.
Why don't we do that one?
Senator Betzel, Senate File 1867.
I believe there's some people here to testify on it. If they would come forward at this time, that would be greatly appreciated. Mr. Chair, the Senate File 1867 deals with an issue, and actually, if you wanted to get the flavor of what we're doing here, you really need to look at the page 5 first, because we have, in the Department of Administration, we have something called the Land Management Information Center, and that does a lot of the surveying. They keep track of a lot of the data regarding the land around the state. So this would transfer the duties to the new Geospatial Information Office within the Department of Administration, and we do have some people who are well-versed, you know, in what's called LIMIC, the Land Management Information Center, and are able to discuss this particular proposal, so I'll defer to them.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members. Hi, my name is Sheila Rieger, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration. This bill is the result of work from a Drive to Excellence project that was initiated in January of 2007. It was generated by the Geographic Information System, the GIS, community, following extensive strategic planning and a Compass Point retreat they held in June of 2007. Participants included cities, counties, the U.S. Geological Survey, and private sector interests. The group recognized the need for more coordination and leadership in Minnesota. The leadership is needed because GIS has become really an important foundation for many critical government systems and programs. One example is that GIS is offering key support to the emergency operations centers right now in dealing with the flood situation. Staff were on call around the clock during some of the critical times, and they continue to offer key technical service to help manage the disaster. Minnesota's current GIS work is really fragmented. More than a dozen different state agencies are spending an estimated $12 to $20 million annually, and this number is growing, roughly 10 to 15% each year. So this proposal creates an enterprise governance over GIS, much like the other Drive to Excellence projects do, like real property, fleet, and grants. It will help to focus the state's investment on its strategic needs. It'll help control costs, for example, working on an enterprise software license versus every agency doing their own licensing. It will do more than the LIMIC's current coordination efforts. It will set standards, propose co-location, consolidation as appropriate, and really have a stronger leadership role. Its hope is to dramatically improve the GIS services across state agencies. So this bill proposes to build upon the current coordination activities that LIMIC currently performs and turn it into the MGIO, Minnesota Geographic Information Office, and give it a broader focus and set of responsibilities. The assets and the base budget of LIMIC, including the revolving fund business, would transfer to the new office. With these existing resources, the MGIO office can get off the ground and begin to implement the strategy outlined by that working group I mentioned earlier. No additional funds have been requested at this time due to, well, in recognition of the economy at present. So step one will be to create the office and begin the work. Indeed, with the possibility of further investment in years to come, even more GIS benefit can be brought to Minnesota. Now I'd like to turn it over to David Arbeit, who can quickly walk through the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Arbeit. I direct the Land Management Information Center and also direct the Office of Geographic and Demographic Analysis in the Department of Administration. I'm really happy to bring this bill to you and really very grateful for Senator Betzholt for carrying it for us. This bill is a result of 2 to 4 years' worth of pretty intense analysis of the current operations of state agencies as they are implementing GIS technology, and based on a recommendation that comes from a year-long study that was consulted by Applied Geographics, a firm out of Cambridge, Massachusetts, that has advised other states about how to better deploy this technology within the enterprise. The bill looks as though it is completely new, but most of the elements are derived from other pieces of legislation. Part of it is from 4A05, which is the legislation that authorized the Land Management Information Office in 1978, and others replicate parallel language that exists in legislation that created the Office of Enterprise Technology, because it's the intent of this bill to really work in, create a structure that works in harmony with OET and its mission. Section one creates the office in the Department of Administration, reporting to the Commissioner of Administration, as LIMIC currently does. Subdivision 2 describes the responsibilities and authorities of the office, which entirely focus on providing coordination, guidance, leadership to plan the implementation of Minnesota's geospatial information technology. As Deputy Director Rieger indicated, there are really about 15 state agencies that have made significant investments in this technology. It, at a conservatively, is represents $20 million a year of investments, and there is a degree of duplication and overlap that we feel can be addressed through this office in a way that it currently cannot. Subdivision 3 is much more specific about the duties of the office, duties that will support the responsibilities outlined in Subdivision 2, and they entirely reflect recommendations that came out of that year-long study, which included as stakeholders and participants every state agency, as well as representatives of organizations outside of state government in county and local government, in the university sector and private sector stakeholders of the state's state agencies. It includes a number of responsibilities that are very similar to those that you'll find are embedded or assigned to the Office of Enterprise Technology, and acknowledges that this office will work closely with the state CIO, and in fact, this has the blessing of the state CIO. The Subdivision 4 specifically talks about the duties of the head of this office, which is called the Chief Geospatial Information Officer. In some respects, it reflects the framework and the structure that currently is in place for a state's Chief Information Security Officer. It identifies, among other things, what this officer is expected to do and how the office operates. And makes it very clear that the officer takes consults with a state geospatial advisory council and takes advice with and works with the Office of Enterprise Technology. The Subdivision 5, which refers to fees, and I might add this is not new language. This is actually language that except for the substitution of the Minnesota Geospatial Information Officer or Office reflects language that has been in place since 1978 to fund some activities of the Land Management Information Center, which are run, operated on a project basis, a cost recovery project basis, and the intent here is for that to continue to operate as it has in the past. Subdivision 6 makes it clear that the Chief Geospatial Information Officer is appointed by the Commissioner of Administration and, as I've mentioned before, works closely with the state CIO. Subdivision 7 provides discretionary powers that allow the office to do things like enter into contracts, apply for receipt for grants, appoint committees and task forces as are identified here, conduct studies. It's pretty much purely operational. Subdivision 8 is a key subdivision of this bill, and it is something strongly supported by and encouraged by the stakeholders of this office, which involves creation of two advisory councils. The first one is called a statewide advisory council, and in effect, it entirely replaces, at its own recommendation, what's currently created under executive order as the Minnesota Governor's Council on Geographic Information. Its role is to advise this new office about issues, priorities, statewide policies that affect the community of GIS users around the state, including those in counties and especially those in counties who are key partners of the state. And Subdivision 8, Section B, or C, provides for a, B, provides for a state agency, state government geospatial advisory council, which does not exist right now, which is a key council that would provide advice to the MGIO about policies that affect state agencies. This parallels the structure that you find at OET is implemented to work with the state CIO, agency CIO council, and is a way for us to focus entirely on state government business. The office will provide administrative support to both of these councils. Subdivision 9 deals with some sort of loose ends that would be left over, relate to a legacy legislation that's been created over the last 30 years since LIMIC was first created that identifies references to the Land Management Information Center and the Land Management Information System, which actually no longer exists, in a number of places in state statute. And this gives us until January 15th to take a look at all of those and recommend which of those should stay, which of those should be modified, which of those should really have served their purpose. Section 2 then technically provides for the transfer of funds, assets, employees, and equipment from the Land Management Information Center to this new office. It in a way, affirms or confirms this notion that LIMIC is not going away. The services that LIMIC provides will continue to function in this new office. And Section 3 is a technical instructions to the reviser to make some changes. Section 4 repeals the old LIMIC statute. And Section 5 indicates that this goes into effect after it's been enacted. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Metzl. Just,
and I did not draft the language that's in the bill, but we probably may want to, as a technical matter, on the bottom of page 4, lines 4.31 to 4.35, just modify the language there so that the report will go to the appropriate chairs and the ranking minority members of the committees. And I don't know that there's any other committees in the either by the legislature that review these issues other than the state government policy and budget division, so perhaps we could just tighten up that language a bit, and I'll defer to council to ponder that for a minute or two. So, but other than that, I think that is the we have a Eagan resident apparently who wishes to testify as well, too.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Steve Swayze. I'm a resident of Eagan and a concerned citizen.
Okay. Here, the page will hand it out. Just right there.
The purpose of my testimony this afternoon on behalf of this bill, first of all, I would like to start out and make known to you that no matter what I may say or thought give to you, that I am in full support of the bill as being offered, and I would request that even if you may find doubt by after I get done saying what I'm about to say, that the bill be put forward as quickly as possible. The reason I'm here this afternoon is that I serve currently as a co-chair of the Emergency Preparedness Committee of the Minnesota Governor's Council on Geographic Information. I also previously served as the Department of Defense Liaison Officer to the state of Minnesota from 2001 to 2004, worked on national programs, was the Senior Emergency Preparedness Liaison Officer deployed to the Pentagon during Katrina, Ophelia, Rita, and Wilma. Subsequent to that, I participated in a program on a national level for the development of a product known as a common operating picture between the Department of Defense and the Department of Homeland Security. The reason that I'm here is, number one, I would, as I indicated previously, would like to offer my most heartfelt support for the concept of moving to a node in Minnesota government that will serve as the geospatial coordination, planning, and entity that will move forward with an enterprise engagement. However, my reservation with the bill as it currently has been given before you is that it fails to address a pressing need in both Minnesota government and nationally. And that being that there is a recognition that geographic information systems have a critical place in the advancement of the disaster response and preparedness function of instances as are currently going forward in the Red River instance. And why this is a problem is, number one, it is a core function of government that we have protection and safety of our citizenry. The second point I would make to you is that the extent of GIS programs and efforts with an emergency preparedness and response focus is already substantial and growing. And that figure that is on the sheet that I've passed out, figure A, gives you an idea of the degree to which GIS has exploded into the world of emergency management and preparedness. It is growing at a phenomenal rate. As an example, item 3, bullet 3 down there, shows that currently our Emergency Preparedness Committee in this state has grown from 17 to 155 in a mere period of 18 months. The next point down there on the line that I would point you to is number 4, that post 9/11 Katrina, the findings were put forward both inside the reports that came out of those developments and also in the National Incident Management System and the National Response Framework clearly relate the need for this item called a common operating picture, a geospatial depiction, awareness of what is taking place in a disaster or a response effort. If you flip over to the backside onto figure B, the point that I would like to direct you to there is that with the I-35W bridge collapse, you had a mere, and as regretful as it was, the loss of 13 lives and 100 and some injured. The reality is, if you look across, for instance, pandemic flu outbreak in 1918, the dimensions of what we could be faced with a natural disaster are such, or a, in this case, a health problem, are so large that we need to do everything we humanly can to put in the hands of the response community the best possible technology. If you look down at number 5, that's a picture from the I-35W bridge collapse. That being that Minnesota stands unique in that we are only one of three states in the Union which does not have a major military installation in our territory. The significance of that is federal. I'll correct that as being a federal facility inside our territory. The significance of that is that we lack the ability to receive immediate response from the Department of Defense, which in turn drives the need for us to, again, have the best possible emergency response and preparedness capabilities that we can field. If you look down to number six, you'll see that Minnesota has spent huge sums on systems that create verbal situational awareness, but nothing on systems that create visualization or geospatial situational awareness. The examples being there, I think we're approaching $300 million in terms of the verbal communications efforts that have been put into the state, and to the best of my knowledge, zero has been spent. These are requirements that are driven by, as I said, national programs that we have in place, visualization products, and we are far from being able to say that we have done that. Item seven, currently there is no requirement in this state to share geospatial information across boundaries, political boundaries, which is a huge issue when you come to the matter of responding to a disaster. Because situational awareness, the element of knowing where things are and how to respond, is a first in, last out technology, just like radios and telephones are. So here's what I'm suggesting to you, that the deficiency in the bill before you is that it fails to assign to the office that's about to be created the responsibility for serving as the node in Minnesota government for the purposes of collaboration and putting forward the technologies that should be put in place for this type of response. And what I would suggest to you is that in some form or fashion that a identified node be created in the new office that is about to be created, or provided the bill moves out, that has this specific charter. That's the extent of my comments.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, just trying to figure this out. I chair the Veterans Committee, and if there's a disaster here, with the governor's help, we can have the National Guard here just about immediately, because we've done that. So we maybe don't have a big military base, but we do have a National Guard system that's ready to go on a minute's notice.
Sir, I have, Mr. Chair, I have no argument with that point. I would tell you a story that in January of 2004, I was asked to speak at a lecture down in New Orleans, Louisiana, and the individual that spoke before me was from the Louisiana National Guard, who promptly told us all that they were never going to have a problem in Louisiana, that federal troops would never end up in the state of Louisiana, and they dealt with hurricanes many times before. What I'm trying to do is recage the thought here that the dimensions of what we may face at some point in the future, for instance, Chernobyl accident, is an accident which reached $200 billion, 336,000 people had to be evacuated, and over 600,000 people were exposed to some level of radiation. So what I'm afraid has happened here is if we have allowed ourselves to get our brains set in the world that being able to respond to a I-35W bridge collapse or even a Red River incident, that we're doing great, we have to be prepared for the next level.
Mr. Swayze, are you suggesting that perhaps we have Subdivision 9, the report to the legislature, and it does say that make the recommendations about what should be continued, amended, or repealed. Are you suggesting that there should be something added to that as far as these responsibilities go?
For instance, in the state of Wisconsin, they have three primary things that have been identified as they created the office, as has been the case with the state of California. And specifically, the responsibility, as I've just related to you, is defined and sent to those institutions.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Betzold, any comments?
I don't know. Do we have any suggested language to clean up that part at the bottom of page 4? I don't know.
Yes. Mr. Boddard.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Betzold, I got a little ways into this and kept going, so if you'll bear with me. On page 4, line 32, delete appropriate, and then after chairs, insert and ranking minority members, and then delete state government. And then on page 4, line 33, before committees, insert legislative, and then delete of the legislature that addresses, and insert with jurisdiction over the policy and budget for the office, period, the report must address. And I'll read to you how this will read. And then on page 4, line 34, the other thing I noted, I think that Senator, that we've discussed with respect to the guidelines, is the inclusion of draft legislation, which I think this is intended to address. So on page 4, line 34, delete everything after and. And then on page 4, line 35, delete everything before the period and insert, provide any necessary legislation, draft legislation, to implement any recommendations. So the whole report to the legislature subdivision would read, by January 15th, 2010, the Chief Geospatial Information Officer shall provide a report to the chairs and ranking minority members of the legislative committees with jurisdiction over the policy and budget for the office. The report must address all statutes, et cetera, and provide any necessary draft legislation to implement any recommendations.
Also move, Mr. Chair.
Senator Betzold moves language to correct the report and define what is reported. Any questions from the committee? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Betzold, did you have...
I don't know if there's anybody else who's here on the bill, Mr. Chair. If not, I would move that Senate File 1867 as amended be recommended pass be re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Betzel, under the advisory councils, those are kind of loose, don't you think? Because generally, you're pretty supportive, I think, of a more prescriptive, you know, how people are getting paid, how many members. You know, it's just kind of wide open on both of the statewide and for the state government one.
Mr. Chairman?
Council.
One distinction I'll point out with both of these councils is, and there are significant differences, but this is basically direction to the executive branch, the specific agency, to form the advisory council, which is a little bit different from some of the multi-member task forces and work groups that the committee has looked at in the past. And I think there's sufficient guidance here to meet the guidelines with respect to some of the other items.
Just to follow up then, Mr. Chair, Mr. Bodner, would there be anything in those about pay or reimbursements or those kinds of things?
Senator Council.
Mr. Chairman, there's nothing in here I can find that provides for per diem or payment of expenses. It might be unclear whether the commissioners have their own authority to form working groups within statute. They can do that independently. I believe if they do that, they can use some of their budget to provide expenses to members. It might be worthwhile to clarify whether or not that authority would exist here.
Mr. Chair, that would obviously be a budget issue, and if it goes to the Finance Committee, it would be heard in the State Government Budget Division, and, of course, we would certainly consider that there. But it's a legitimate question. Are they going to be paying per diem or not? But it's a fiscal issue that would have to be looked at in the Finance Committee.
Mr. Chairman, this is
Mr. Rodder.
One other item I should point out, too. Looking at the membership here, at least with respect to the State Government Geospatial Advisory Council in paragraph B, that appears to be composed exclusively of members representing state government agencies and constitutional offices. So the expense question would that kind of answers that issue. But the statewide council in paragraph A does have, from what I can tell, non-state government members.
Any other questions from the committee?
I'll renew my motion, Mr. Chair.
Senator Betzel moves Senate file
1867.
1867, as amended, be recommended to pass and forward to the Committee on Finance. Any final questions? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Okay, we'll take Senator Ingebretson.
Senator Ingebretson, welcome to the committee. Senate File 1489 is before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Ingebretson, I see you have a delete all the
yes,
A1 amendment. Is this the committee of the first committee that this bill has
yes.
been to?
Yes, it has. It's the A1.
In that case, Senator Roebling moves the A1 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. Senator Ingebretson, to the bill and the amendment.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for hearing this bill. Give you a little background, if I can, then I'll introduce the witnesses that will help you with questions if you have any. Back in 2003, Representatives Westrom, Otremba, and the late Senator Sams introduced a bill to create the state allowed the creation of the CLRSD, which is Central Lakes Regional Sewer District, which basically sits right in the middle of District 11, west of Alexandria, north and west, and some south of Alexandria. And over the past years, this has grown into three different phases, including six different townships. Over the makings of the and the business of the sewer district, when it came time here just recently to put dollars and cents to the figures with the three different phases that were, you know, to say the very least, the expense of the system was growing and growing and growing, and it started to get the attention of property owners. Some may say somewhat late in the process, but nevertheless, it did happen, and an awful lot of folks started making a lot of noise about what the cost was going to be. There was dollars that were applied for by myself and Representative Westrom and Otremba to the state of Minnesota and federal dollars, and we were unable to obtain any significant dollars to offset the costs of the property owners. So their concerns, of course, were the hookup fees, tax assessments, and the ongoing monthly fees, which were to a lot of the residents in this particular area very, very costly. And that's what was brought to our attention, and we decided that at that point that we would take a look at this. The 2003 legislation also had an opt-out clause, and with that opt-out clause, all six townships that were initially involved in this now have opted out. And we're here today to basically put this organization to disillusion. And I think without me moving any further than that, if you don't have any questions of me, I'll move on to the testifiers. One is the Julie Hausman, who's the township legal supervisor, I believe, for some of the townships. I'm not sure if all of them are. But also is Jim Mogan from the CLRSD legal counsel is here to testify. So I'd ask Julie to ask. Go ahead.
Ms. Hausman, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you. My name is Julie Hausman, and I'm the attorney representing five out of the six participating townships. I represent Carlos, LeGrand, Leaf Valley, Miltona, and Moe Township. I've also been in communication with Attorney Bill Luthner, who represents Brandon Township, and with Kent Sulem and Dan Greenswig at Minnesota Association of Townships. And on behalf of all of those, I can say that there is unanimous support for the bill in the language as proposed. What you have in front of you is the language that has been through the committees through the House. It is, long story short, primarily important, very important, that this legislation be passed so that the dissolution process can be handled in the best way possible. The 2003 legislation did not anticipate dissolution of the sewer district before pipes were in the ground. And so a chunk of the bill kind of handles dissolution process similar to a corporation that has assets and liabilities, and how are we going to take care of those. And then the 2003 legislation provides the power to CLSD to allocate costs to the townships, which the township then must pay. And the language for the ability for the township to pay those bills in the 2003 legislation kind of anticipated that there'd be pipes in the ground and sewer service, which is not the case. And so that's primarily what this bill remedies. Are there any questions of me?
Your next testifier, Senator Ingebrigtsen. Sir, if you'd please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you. My name is Jim Mogan. I represent the CLSRD, CLRSD. And I don't really have anything in addition to add except to stress that the original enabling legislation did not provide for the dissolution in the case that we are. We're going to be in a situation in which we have no townships participating, but no way really to dissolve the organization and to allocate the expenses to the townships in a way that's fair and easy for the member townships to collect from their residents. The proposed legislation does provide for that mechanism and ensures the flexibility of the townships to acquire, to collect for the cost, their share of the cost of the planning and implementation up to this point. So if there's no other further questions, Madam Chair.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Ingebrigtsen, are the waters that this was going to be, you know, have a sewer for, are they impaired at all, or?
I'm not sure exactly if I can answer that, but I believe most recently they might have been put on that particular list. Now, that list, of course, has grown over the years, but I'm not sure exactly of that answer, Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair.
General
Olsen. Well, Senator Ingebrigtsen, it seems like it's, you know, I think there's some areas in my area that would like to have an organization in place like this. I'm surprised that it's not going forward. It seems like now more than ever that we'd be looking at these kinds of sewering districts, and so I'm kind of surprised it's not happening.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Madam Chair, Ms. Hausman would like to respond, then I'll also respond myself.
Oh, okay. They're still addressing the need for some kind of sewer system through the lakes. Since I represent the townships and I did not represent CLRSD, the sewer district itself, I was not in those meetings as far as when they had experts in water quality, that kind of thing. But I know that there has been discussion of cluster systems, maybe some adjoining ALASD, which is a sewer district through Alexandria. There's been some discussion of whether it be Miltona or Carlos, but maybe not the big one system that primarily I believe it was cost, you know, unless there was more funding, but there's no cost.
Madam Chair and Senator Olsen, you know, that certainly answered it, but there just got to be just a terrible, terrible cost here, and there just was no dollars involved. And to your answer, still moving forward, she answered it very well. They are still looking at other alternatives. And depending upon who you talk to out in the rural area there, they will tell you that there may have not been enough study done on some of the other alternatives. But, no, there definitely is. The city of Carlos and the city of Miltona would have been involved in this are seriously looking at partnering up themselves and the possibility of them purchasing the permit, actually, that's still active there from the study. So. No, I don't think the thing it's going away totally. It's just it just became very cost prohibitive in its fashion, and that's why they decided to opt out right now.
Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on Senate File 1489? Senator Roebling?
No, Madam Chair, I was just ready to move the bill if there is no further discussion.
Thank you. Senator Roebling moves that Senate File 1489 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator.
Madam Chair, members, thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Cohen, Senate File 1481. Senator Cohen, we're sorry for making you wait.
No, we're not.
No, we're not.
No, we're not. Not even.
It's fine now, Madam Chair. I'm sure I noticed we have the commissioner here, so he's going to pay very close attention to this because I think you have, a bill of Senator Gimsey's that changes the name of his agency. I thought he was going to come in and either help me out on this bill or testify against it. So this is a bill, Madam Chair and members, Senate File 1481, that incorporates the recommendations of the Fiscal Trends Commission that we established 2 years ago in an effort to, the Budget Trends Commission, not the Fiscal Trends, the Budget Trends Commission. I don't think this was made part of the packets. I don't know how many people have had a chance to go through the report that was promulgated by the commission. The commission, I'll remind members, was a bipartisan commission with appointees from the executive branch, appointees from by the governor, appointees by the legislative leaders of both bodies, with on a bipartisan basis. And the co-chairs of the group were former Commissioner Kevin Goodnow and former Commissioner Jay Kudrowski. Mitch Kudrowski was going to try to be here today and could not. I believe he's out of town, so he could not be present. Also, I'm looking at the membership. We had other former commissioners of finance, John Gunyu, Peggy Ingeson, and Pam Wheelock. So commissioners of finance representing all sides of administrations, Democrat, Republican, Independent. Former Representative Jim Knobloch was a member of the commission. Art Rolnick from the Fed, Glenn Dorfman, somebody I served with, and we miss him a great deal, of former Representative Senator John Brandel was on the commission. And they worked very hard over the couple of years putting this together. And so this legislation incorporates the recommendations made. And I'm going to ask for a little bit of help from Mr. Mossman. I believe these recommendations were unanimous recommendations from the commission. There were significant majority and minority opinions, but I believe what's represented here is the strong consensus of the commission. And in an effort to attempt to provide a more structurally balanced budget, to do some of the things that would enable us to get away from some of the feast or famine kinds of environments we've been in. Madam Chair and members, this does not make recommendations in terms of revenues. Should we raise taxes? Should we lower taxes? Or what we ought to do relative to that, but deals on more the budget side of it. So it calls for the reestablishment of the Office of Strategic and Long-Range Planning as an independent agency, with the director being the state planning officer. One of the things that the commission focused on, and that's why I wish either Mr. Goodnow or Mr. Kudrowski were able to be here, one of the things that the commission focused on was our inability in putting the budget together to look at things on a long-range basis in terms of planning what we do fiscally. So you'll find a lot of language in this bill, as you will in the commission report, relative to putting the demographer within this agency, coming up with a demographic study and recommendations in terms of where the state's demography is going, not just simply the budget issues itself in terms of a forecast. And you'll find that, I think, in the latter part of the bill, if I'm not mistaken, or maybe I'm sorry, that's in Section 4 of the bill, the demographic trends analysis. To take a look at as the language suggests, demographic trends for state revenues and expenditures for 10 and 20 years beyond the forecast period. So obviously, here at the legislature, we tend to take a look at this stuff on a more narrow basis. We get into session as we are now, and obviously we got to put together a budget for this next biennium. Starting with Governor Carlson, we began to also take a look at the so-called out years, the subsequent biennium. This recommends that we take a look at an analysis that goes far beyond that. So we have some sense of what we might expect. and that's why it calls for the reestablishment of the office and transfers the Office of Geographic and Demographic Analysis as well as the state demographer into this office so we can do a better job looking at the demography and what that means for the budget. Other language in the bill calls for a structurally balanced budget similar to the legislation we passed off the floor about a month ago in terms of requesting the governor recommendations for a shortfall in the next biennium. We also have one of my old favorites, which is the reinstatement of inflation in the budget forecast. I've had separate legislation to do that going back to 2003. I want to be a little bit careful, but because we've had a lot of debate about that issue in the legislature. In 2002, when that was done, and that was a Senate position at the time, there is one person who had raised concerns, and that was myself. And I don't want to present myself as any great legislative seer in that respect, but I went to Senator Moe and I just kind of said, you know, I think this is a good idea. Should we do it? And he said, yeah, I think it's okay. That was the extent of my objection, but I don't think any of us really at the time had a more comprehensive view on how that might affect how we view an appropriate budget. There's also language in here relative to the budget reserve, and it sets out the establishment ultimately of a reserve that would be 5% of the general fund expenditures. Obviously, we now have the budget reserve set at $653 million. As we know, the budget reserve now is down to zero. And if we had a budget reserve of 5%, that would be more comparable to a figure of about $1.6 billion. If Mr. Mossman is writing a note to correct me, thank you. $1.8 billion, so a little bit higher than what I thought. And it also calls again, similar to the demography section, also calls on the promulgation of reports on the budget reserve as to what's working. So it requests of the Commissioner of Finance, obviously, if I believe that Senator Gimsey's bill passes, we would have to change the language in terms of the actual commissioners, the naming of the commissioner, but to ask the commissioner to take a look at what works or doesn't work over a much lengthier period of time relative to the general fund expenditures vis-a-vis the budget reserve. So, Madam Chair, I know it's the bill deadline day, and you've got a long agenda. I can go on for quite a while about this in terms of what the commission did. I should also mention relative to the commission, the explicit intent, and I authored the legislation setting up the budget commission along with Representative Lencheski in the House. Our intent was to not have legislators participate on this. So if you look at the names of commission members, you don't have any legislators. Again, former Representative Knobloch was a member of the commission. Mr. Mossman from our staff, Mr. Mark from the House staff, generally attended all the commission hearings. Mr. Mossman could certainly offer some testimony to the committee as to the process of the commission, what took place. But the intent is to try to keep going the work of some significant folks in the state working in a collaborative process to do something, again, about getting away from the feast or famine environment we've been having relative to the state budget. So, Madam Chair, that's a quick summary of the legislation. Again, I can go into much greater detail about what the commission did, and I again would refer members to, and maybe I should have had this distributed, to the actual commission report. Again, I don't know how many people saw this at the outset. It's online. Yeah, and it's online. Okay.
Senator Cohen.
It's on Mr. Mossman, who's doing a great job helping me out here, points out it's on the MMMB website.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. Mr. Mossman, did you want to provide testimony, or are you just here to answer questions?
Madam Chair, I can answer any questions you might have. The one thing I would just kind of add is that the commission looked extensively at in Section 8. You'll see there's a lot of language with regard to how the commission arrived at the budget reserve, and how the commissioner of finance and the agency would evaluate what the reserve would be, ought to be over the long term, and that's new relative to how we have looked at the reserve in the past, just setting it to moderate the relative volatility in our revenue stream over time.
Thank you. Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, we had $653 million as a budget reserve account goal. How does that compare to the 2% that is being put in this bill?
Mr. Mosman?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, if you look actually at, there's two provisions relative to growing of the budget reserve. What would happen in the language that you're looking at is 2% would go in immediately. So that would be under Section 16A.152, their first priority after the cash flow account, which is at $350 million now, would be to put 2% into the budget reserve. And then subsequent to that, if you turn to page 4, and if the numbers are on my are the same, it's line 4.3 of the bill. An additional 25% of any forecast surpluses after the 2% has been put in would go into the budget reserve until it was built up to 5%. So what would happen is above the 2% level, there would, when you had a positive forecast with a positive balance, some of that money would remain in the forecast for the legislature to determine how they wanted to use it, and 25% of it would go into the reserve. So in difference to it, under current law with the 653, no money shows up in the forecast until the 653 is reached. In this case, instead of saying no money shows up in the forecast until the $1.8 billion is reached, instead you would put roughly $600 million into the reserve, and then the remaining $1.2 billion would go in gradually over time.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on Senate File 1481? Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 1481 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails.
Madam Chair, members, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. Senator Torres-Ray is not here. Senator Lori, would you like to go next?
Sure.
Senate File 1436.
Madam Chair and members, Senate File 1436.
And Senator Lori, I understand we're looking at Section 1 of this bill.
Section 1 and Section 1 alone, yep. Section 1 provides an exemption from the state's procurement process for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, similar to the exemption offered to many other state-operated services, DT&H providers, rehab providers, the Department of Corrections. Basically, this allows state agencies to purchase items from these other preferred state vendors without going through the entire procurement process. And that's really the an important piece, I guess, is that the Materials Management Division of the Department of Admin has reviewed this section and supports it. That's all it does. I mean, we'd stand for questions.
Senator Lori, could you just provide a brief explanation as to why you need this exemption or would like it?
Well, I mean, this is one of the things that it would allow for state programs to purchase from this agency, the same as it does for many other state-operated programs. Some of the things that it makes, MSOP makes little signs, and it does small fulfillment contracts, and this would allow other state agencies to utilize those services without going through the full procurement process. I do have the MSOP executive assistant director here, Dan Storkamp, to answer specific questions, but it's really, it just eases the process a little bit. It's something that we've done for many of our state programs, and MSOP is really no different than this other list. You can see the list on page 1 and 2 there.
Right.
It would be adding number 8 to the list of state services that.
Great. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on Senate File 1436? Senator Lori moves that Senate File 1436 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor.
I think it needs to go to finance. Not much to my chagrin, but.
Senator Lori then moves that Senate File 1436 be recommended to pass and referred to finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Lori.
Madam Chair, Senator Lori, didn't you want to go to judiciary?
Uh-huh. I've been there. You missed it. I talked to you about it.
Send it back.
Before you left.
I know. Send it back. Okay.
Senator Gimsey, you ready? Senate File 1297.
Chair, members, thank you for hearing Senate File 1297. And what this bill does is make some statutory changes that are needed to codify in statute an executive order that dates back to July of 2008. And fortunately for us, we have Commissioner Tom Hansen here to walk us through the bill. But I believe before we do that, I have an A1 author's amendment.
Senator Gimsey,
like
we need to have that distributed if you'd like to explain it while it's being passed around.
A portion of the A1 amendment would actually change back a portion of this bill. I also have another bill which Senator Cohen referred to that would change the name of two. Yeah, and this isn't the bill, but it would change the name of two other programs to the Minnesota Management and Budget, and that hasn't happened yet, so we need to make some adjustments while we wait for that bill to be approved. And the subdivision one, which is about setting rates for the special fund that this bill that we're going to hear today will establish, this just clarifies the funds that would be included in the agency's revolving fund services. And then the rest of the bills from the rest of the lines from 1.14 to 1.23, again, are just kind of changing some language back while we wait for that other bill to be approved. Pass.
Are there questions on the A1 amendment? Is this
maybe Mr. Bodern, if he feels it's necessary to clarify even more on the amendment?
Madam Chair, one thing I did want to point out, just because of the way the amendment was put together, there are actually only, if you look at that list of citations on beginning on line 10 of the amendment through line 13, there are really only a couple of new funds being added there. But those are all subject to the approval of the Commissioner of Finance.
Senator Gimsey moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
You need to be voted.
Commissioner, welcome to the committee. We're
not on this. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Senator Gimsey described the bill quite well. This is really one of the final steps of merging the Department of Employee Relations and the Department of Finance, which began in this committee in 2007 and authored by Senator Rest. I'd like to thank her for her authorship then and her support, as well as Senator Betzold in making this transition for our agencies as smooth as possible. This summer, the governor, by executive order, transferred the Management Analysis Division from the Department of Administration to the Department of Finance, effective August 20th, 2008. And MAD, as it's called, is a natural fit for our combined agency and its new enterprise-wide focus on building capacity for financial, human, informational, and analytical resources across state government. The language, as Senator Gimsey said, it looks a lot more complex than it is.
basically it transfers MADS references from the Department of Administration to the Department of Finance. Section 1 changes the MAD data citations references to finance. Section 2 creates the MAD language in the finance statute. Section 6 establishes MAD internal service fund language. And Section 3 clarifies existing law as to what internal service funds, et cetera, and this is what we amended. With that, I'll answer any questions that you may have, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on this Senate file? Then Senator Gimsey moves that Senate file 1297 as
a... I have a question.
Senator Rest?
Thank you. Excuse me for being late. I had a bill up in another committee. What kind of fiscal note are we going to anticipate on this, Senator Gimsey or Commissioner?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, members.
Other bills that talk about the duties of the commissioner, and they seem to cost a lot of money. What about these? In your additional duties, how much is that going to cost us?
Well, Madam Chair, this is a MAD is primarily run through an internal service fund. Mm-hmm. It isn't I get what you're getting at.
Get what I'm getting at. Mm-hmm.
We have not
real
attached
sharp
a
pencil.
We have not attached a fiscal note to this bill because of their internal service fund. I get your point.
Senator Gimsey renews his motion that Senate File 1297, as amended, be recommended to pass and returned to the referred to the Finance Committee. Excuse me. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed.
Madam Chair. Oh, I'm sorry.
Senator Olstein.
Well, I just noticed.
It's too late.
No, but it sounds like one of those Betzel amendments at 2.22.
2.22.
Senator Olstein, that's current law on all of line 2.22.
But you know where he likes to, well, I think it's just good policy to say that to the, you know, we're not addressing the minority group members at all. That should be new language in there.
Senator Olstein, would you like to move an amendment?
I've already voted on the bill, Chair.
If
someplace
I could.
Else.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Olstein, we try to, on every report, include the minority parties as well. We try to disseminate our information quite broadly.
Madam Chair, Senator Olstein, this can be fixed in the state government by budget division.
So, again, all those in favor of Senate File 1297
as.
We did.
Okay.
Go on.
Well, I didn't.
Just say the bill passes.
Thank you.
Okay. What's next? Who's here? Senator Torres Ray. Senator Torres Ray brings us Senate File 1799.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. As a result of the direction and the request from this committee, I think my bill is now better. And so we are here before you to really put some additional language to make sure that we comply with the guidelines of working groups. And we really appreciate that suggestion. So we have an amendment, the A2 amendment, Madam Chair.
The A2 amendment. Senator Sieben moves the A2 amendment, but since this is not the committee of origin, it needs to be explained before we take it up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. Senate File 1799 helps the state of Minnesota put in place a group that will help the state of Minnesota move in the direction of adopting a better system to deal with Alzheimer's disease. And as you can see in the language, many states are, probably many of you know, many states are putting in place some guidelines and some new protocols to deal with this issue that is becoming really a difficult issue to handle at the state level because of the growing population that is facing Alzheimer's. Madam Chair, please let me know to what extent you want me to go in depth into this. I have an expert with me, an expert witness, who will be happy to provide
not on the policy, Senator Torres-Ray, just
the amendment
and how your working group is set up and your and what your amendment did in order to meet the guidelines.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As you can see, we have a list of individuals who are suggested in the legislation, but we also expanded the number to 20 because we have many organizations who have really requested to be included. The amendment basically includes some language that really clarifies how the appointment should be completed, and again, this is to comply with guidelines of the working groups. It also clarifies that this particular group needs to name a chair in order to convene the meetings and how the group will deal with specific reports and how they will include recommendations in the reports that may require drafting legislation. None of this language was included in our original version, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And so, again, this was suggested, I believe, by council so that we can comply with the protocol and the direction for and the guidelines for working groups for the state of Minnesota.
Okay, we have Senator Sieben's motion, A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Torres-Ray, on line 122, the members to be named by the governor, do you mean to limit that to public members, or where are you indicating that a member might be appointed who is a legislator? If you mean public members, I think it would be helpful to insert between two and members public.
Is it public? Madam Chair and members, I understand there is public.
Public?
So we need to.
Senator Sieben moves on line 122 after the word two to insert public. And I'm trying to go back and forth between your bill and the provisions in subdivision five and the amendment, the private funding. You're not asking for any expenses to be reimbursed under the general section of statute. This is totally a public group that will be completely and totally privately funded.
That is correct, Madam
Chair. Just
want
to make
members.
Sure that's very unusual, Senator Torres-Ray. So I just want to make sure that members note that. Are there any questions about the working group that's established under this this bill, or our comments to Senator Torres-Ray?
Senator Rest, Madam Chair.
Senator Sieben.
Senator Torres-Ray, council informed me that perhaps did you want to think about deleting on line 2.22 the state support of Alzheimer's research through Minnesota universities and other resources?
You need to, Madam Chair and Senator Sieben, could you please tell me again the number?
That indicates
2.22.
Yeah.
It was my understanding that that would remove some of the fiscal costs or any remaining fiscal costs to the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Sieben. In fact, this was suggested and the House adopted that. I wanted to bring before this committee some amendments that deal with this language, but since the versions are so different in both houses, we're going to have to conference this bill anyway. But if we need to put that language, we're not opposed because we're going to have to work on that with the House anyway. So that's, Senator Sieben, the reason I didn't bring an amendment is because I was just told a few minutes ago and I didn't want to really put this committee to go through that policy decision, and I didn't want to postpone this. I didn't have a written amendment, so I will deal with it in conference committee.
Just checking.
Senator Sieben, I guess I would consider that a policy issue rather than a process one.
They asked me to check.
Okay. Is there further discussion on Senate File 1799 as amended? Senator Lurie.
Madam Chair, I thought it was typical. I pulled out our guidelines, too. I thought we usually listed the number of members, not the no more than and a few of these and a couple of these. And I mean, do we want to nail that down to 20 and say who they're going to be? That's typically what we do, but maybe we've relaxed on that one some.
I think we have sometimes, we have done no more than 20 members, including but not limited to. I don't know what that means, though. What is that?
I'll be this guy.
And the including but not limited to, is that 20 people there?
There's less than 20 people listed.
Okay, well, then that's why.
I think.
Because they could have at least one caregiver, but they may choose to have mm-hmm. two caregivers to get up to the 20.
Yeah.
So I think it's it meets the guidelines. Senator.
Okay, I'll pull out the guidelines and read them just now.
Good. Good. That's right. We want everybody to do
the
that.
The total number of people. So I was just...
Our little corner of the world here.
I'm just, you know.
Any other questions or comments? Senator Sieben moves that Senate File 1799 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Madam Chair, sorry, but I believe there is no fiscal note to this, and I think it needs to the floor, I understand.
Maybe I'm reading at the wrong recommendation. Oh, this one's here, that one's here, that one's here, that one's here. Senator Torres-Ray, I think it has to go to finance. It may just make a brief stop there, but it needs to go there. So Senator Sieben's motion is that Senate File 1799 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Senator Torres-Ray, if by chance the appropriate chairs there say straight up that there's no fiscal impact, I would not object to you making a motion to bring it out of finance and go to the floor, if they say, because that has happened on a couple of other bills. All in favor of Senator Sieben's motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Let's see. Did we do this one?
Yeah, we did that.
Okay. Okay, Senator Gerlach. Senator Pappas wants to be here for the discussion of the pension bill. She's on that commission, and so we will move to that last, Senator Betzel. Okay.
Get some folks out here.
Senator Gerlach brings us Senate File 1982. And this is... Veterans preference changes, and you have an author's amendment, and this is the committee of origin. Do we have your amendments, Senator Gerlach?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Is it
actually
coming
yes.
around?
We have one written, the A1 amendment, which you should
okay.
have. And then also there'll be a couple of oral amendments to that. And then also to the
are there
to the bill,
changes to
simple.
The A1
there
amendment?
Are changes.
Okay, you want to tell us what those are?
There, those are. Very simply, you have the A1 on line 1.5. Delete honorably, and then after discharged, insert three words under honorable conditions. So the line would read, who has been discharged under honorable conditions from active service.
Does that involve like a general discharge as well as an honorable discharge? Is that something different?
Well, that's definitional. That
we'll adopt it, and then you explain what that means.
And then one other technical change, a digit that was left out on line 1.12. It says sections 197.46 to 197.48, insert a 1. So it should be 197.481 shall also apply.
Okay.
Missed a digit there. Those are two oral amendments to the A1 amendment. This A1 amendment I'll move that.
Okay, Senator Gerlach moves adoption of the A1 amendment. This is an author's amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Gerlach, did you have other author's amendments that you wanted to offer at this time?
Two very simple ones. Madam Chair, on the bill, on page 2, line 2, it's the same technical change of that missing digit.
Okay.
So on line 2.2, it's going to have to be additional language, so it'll be underscored there, but it should read on line 2.2, 197.481. So we're inserting.
Heard Senator Gerlach's motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
And then lastly, Madam Chair, on line 2.7, it should read the Commissioner of Finance. So delete administration and insert finance. The Commissioner of Finance must collect.
Senator Gerlach moves to strike administration, delete administration, and to insert finance on line 2.7. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Are we set now?
Thank you. We are set, Madam Chair.
Okay.
I appreciate the opportunity to present the bill. I will just tell you that this bill's genesis came as some recommendations from the Department of Veterans Affairs some time ago, and it has wound its way now through the legislature, and we're presenting it here today. This is dealing with veterans' preference. That's a section of law we're dealing with. Our state statutes give veterans preferences for various things, and this is having to do with getting interviews for civil service state jobs. And just to tell you in a little bit of history, prior to 1975, so 74 and below, we had enormous job preferences for veterans. But what happened in 1975 was the pool was widened, the definition of veterans, instead of being very narrowly defined with combat and such, it was widened to include just people who were in the service. And then the benefits, however, were diluted significantly. And what's happened over the decades since is that fewer and fewer veterans' preferences have been effective. The result is that, another example is of we've gone to a system, a human resources system called Resumex. It's a screening system which has essentially canceled out the 5 and 10 point advantage that we've had that system on veterans' preference that we were supposed to provide. That has now essentially effectively been canceled out. So this bill is trying to reverse a trend. You see, there was a report by Dewar on March of 08, just very recently, that showed that the percentage of state employees who are veterans has been on a rapid decline in recent years. In fact, since 2004, 04 to 08, the number of percentage of state employees who are veterans has declined 16%. And this bill is going to get at solving kind of, you know, that issue and getting us some information as to why that is happening. If we look at today, we've got a lot of Guard and Reserve members on active duty who are looking, they're going to be released from active service, and they're going to be looking for employment. We ask our private businesses to hire them back and give them meaningful work. Under a federal reemployment act called USERRA, some of you may be familiar with that. But, again, we've been falling behind at the state level to even guarantee a minimum of an interview for members who meet the minimum qualifications. So this bill changes that. It guarantees an interview if they're veterans who have served in harm's way and are at least minimally qualified. It gives the employee a choice via the Civil Service Collective Bargaining Agreement or a hearing of veterans' preference, but not both. And those are some technical things that we can answer your questions on if need be. It also requires agencies to maintain an ongoing database of veteran information to show numbers of veteran applicants and percentages of those hired and report those numbers to the legislature. That's the section on some of the reporting requirements so we can get some data to know what's going on in that area. And members, I would just say that, you know, today we've got citizen soldiers who are trying to readjust to civilian life after an often intense and life-threatening tour. Reintegrating back into family and community can be overwhelming, and even more so if there's no job to go to. Lack of finances and challenging reintegration add to failed expectations and relational stresses as well. If we as a people are going to ask these men and women to step up and defend our country and freedoms by leaving family and jobs, should we not ensure that they are successfully employed when they come back? And if we're asking our private sector to step up with jobs, shouldn't we be leading the way with our state and local governments? That's what this bill does. I've got two gentlemen here who would like to offer a little bit of comments on the bill. First is Mr. Clint, I could do the German pronunciation, Boucher, or Butcher. I don't want to butcher it.
Maybe if he could say
yes,
his name, we would get it
from
right.
He'll identify where he's from as well.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Clint Bucher. I'm the
Bucher.
Bucher, yes. With the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, I serve as the State Veterans Preference Officer. The Department of Veterans Affairs supports the bill as it's been clarified, and we think it's a very good measure to provide additional assurance that veterans have meaningful preference in the state employment. Thank you.
Could you educate me on what's the difference between honorably discharged and discharged under honorable conditions that we adopted in the A1 amendment?
Madam Chair, members, an honorable discharge is a specific distinction. A medical discharge is a specific distinction, whereas the term under honorable conditions includes.
It's a whole umbrella.
Yes, ma'am. And you asked a question earlier whether that would include general. It would if the general was under honorable conditions.
Got it. Okay. Thank you. Didn't know that. Thank you for your testimony. Would you like to testify, sir?
Yes, ma'am. My name is Jerry Kaiser, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am the chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council that represents the 40-plus veteran and auxiliary organizations in the state of Minnesota, representing the 400,000-plus veterans. And we meet on a monthly basis to talk about legislative issues. So each one of them, those organizations have separate entities. However, on legislative things, we bond together to get this type of legislation done. As a combat veteran from Vietnam, we came back, and we were not treated very nicely. And my motto of my personal organization is never again will veterans be treated like we were. And this is a step in that direction, in the fact that these men and women, this bill talks about, ladies and gentlemen, people from 9/11 forward. Now, actually, some of those men and women in that area would have been Vietnam veterans, but it's talking about these younger people who are coming back trying to get integrated back in. They're citizen soldiers. And they have not been able to get those interviews. One gentleman testified in another committee that he had came back after 22 months in Iraq as a lieutenant and a squad leader. And he applied to many different state organizations and never even got a phone call back that he was even decided to look at. That computer program didn't pick him out. So this at least gets these ladies and gentlemen who served our country well, at least it gets them to have an interview, a face-to-face, kneecap to kneecap, and to put forth what they really are, because they're really, in my opinion, the next greatest generation. And we, as the veterans in the state of Minnesota, support this wholeheartedly, and we'd like to see this as just another part of making Minnesota more veteran-friendly. And I'm just proud that they're doing this.
Thank you, Mr. Kaiser, and thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Are there questions for Senator Gerlach or Mr. Bucher or Mr. Kaiser? Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, I'm trying to refresh my memory. I've been asked why this didn't go to Ag and Vets, but I believe I made the decision.
It's going there now.
We need to kind of fast-track this because it would have passed through Ag.
Senator Gerlach,
we
Senator
talked
Vickerman,
about
it's going to go to Finance, so you will have a chance to look at it at within the finance division of Ag.
No, and Madam Chair, mm-hmm. I was asked why it didn't come, and I didn't want to see it because we didn't have time. Am I right?
You passed on it, Senator Biggerman.
Right. That's what I believe it was, Mr. Chairman and Senator Vickerman, was we needed to move it quickly, and yes.
Right.
And since your division would have a chance to look at it, could kill two birds with one stone there. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to ask a general question. Senator Gerlach had mentioned that there was a 16% decline in veterans employed by the state. And I'm wondering, though, does it not correlate to the smaller percent of veterans in general in maybe the last 10 or 15 years that we've had since the Vietnam era when troop sizes started to decline? Or how does that correlate, or do we really have a serious problem here?
Well, Senator, Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, that's what we hope to find out. And the decrease was recently, just 04 to 08. It was very rapid over a short period of time. But Clint knows some of the details from the report. I don't know if it hypothesized onto the rationale why, but that's what we want to do some of this reporting is to find out why.
Mr. Buecher.
Madam Chair, address your question, the report study came out in March 2008. From the department at that Department of Employee Relations, setting the decline from 2004-2008, gave us a percentage, did not go into detail as to what that may have been a result of that, which I'm speculating now I think was part of the reason Representative Severson wanted that issue addressed. What is going on there? And I think the intent in part of this particular bill is to try to address specifics and to come back next year and the year after that and show how many applied, how many are retiring, and so forth, to give that specific data at that time.
Thank you.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Gerlach, I'm understanding the amendment to be so that you're only giving preference to veterans who have served since September 11th, and I'm wondering why that is and why it's not any veteran who has served who's applying for a position.
Sure. Senator Gerlach.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Sieben. Really, the bulk of the A1 amendment came from what was negotiated and agreed to in committees in the other body, and so that's why I'm choosing my words carefully. Certainly, yes, as you probably know, I mean, just like Senator Vickerman is a leader here in the Senate on veterans issues, Representative Severson is spearheading a lot of these efforts over in the House. And as they were working through some of those things, this is what they came up with, and we're trying to make the bills, as close as we can here together so that we have minimal conference committee and we can move it along. I do not know what some of the argumentation was as far as why that was. I don't have an answer for you. I can try to figure. Maybe you were present at the hearing. Maybe you can offer some of the background.
Madam Chair, members, in my recollection of Mr. Severson's intent, he was concerned that we focus upon getting jobs to recently separated veterans. And to operationally define what he meant by recently separated, he selected the date of September 11th, 2001.
And that's a meaningful date for us, but any other date would also be an arbitrary date in order to define what recent means. I mean, if that was something other than an important date, you could have said September 13th. But that's why that was chosen. Is there further discussion of Senate File 1982? I believe Mr. Bodern has a technical amendment to suggest to you, Senator Gerlach. Mr. Bodern.
Madam Chair and Senator Gerlach, in putting the A1 amendment together, I think I overlooked the application of that new definition for recently separated veteran. In other words, you provide the definition with the amendment, but it's not put into use in Section 1. So to do that, you would, on page 1, line 15, before veteran, insert recently separated to give that new definition the effect.
Mr. Bodern, again, what is the line number?
Page 1, line 15 of the bill, before veteran, the first veteran, insert recently separated.
Senator Gerlach moves on line 115 before the first veteran to insert recently separated. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there further discussion? Is there anyone else who wishes to speak on Senate File 1982? Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lori Hansen, Minnesota Management and Budget. The department understands the intent and the focus of this bill, but we want to share with the committee the procedural changes the bill introduces. First, a new requirement that would require a recently separated veteran to be granted an interview for a position if the veteran meets the minimum qualifications. And currently, there are no other applicants in our applicant pool who are required to receive an interview. Second, the bill expands to the state civil service veterans preference hearing for veterans who are laid off or terminated from employment. And the current process allows all employees access to a process under the employee's collective bargaining agreement or other compensation plan. The third provision would require that a new report be created and submitted each January to the legislature.
Senator Gerlach, any response to the concerns of finance?
Well, Madam Chair, I would just say that we have been in discussion. In fact, just earlier I was talking to Commissioner Hansen about this, and he said that it's a good bill and that we'll continue to work on any
on the fiscal impact.
On the fiscal impact as we go forward. It's going to finance next.
Is there further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Gerlach moves that Senate File 1982, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Gerlach, Senator Tomasoni. Senator Tomasoni brings us Senate File 702. Senator Tomasoni, do you have an amendment?
I would lead all amendment, Madam Chair.
Okay.
It's an A5 amendment.
Then we need to see that. And Senator, it's not exactly a delete all amendment, I guess.
It's not exactly.
It's a page in line.
Yes, it's not exactly.
For us, but. Senator Olsen, on behalf of the author, moves the A5 amendment. This is the first committee. All in favor of the A5 amendment, including
the delete
a handwritten addition. Is that on what people have?
No. Madam Chair, I can clarify that.
Okay. Mr. Bottom, would you explain?
There are a couple minor changes that need to be made to the amendment that
were let's make those first, and then we'll adopt it.
They can be incorporated. On page 1, line 2 of the amendment, before sick, insert or. And then on page 1, this would be included in the amendment to amend the bill on page 1, line 12, delete the new language.
So what was the first thing that you just said?
On the amendment, on page 1, line 2, it should read delete or sick. So delete, insert an or before sick.
And then in line, and then adding line 12, delete new language, the new language?
Right. On page 1, line 12 of the bill, delete the new language.
And that doesn't change the head note, does it, Mr. Bottern?
Madam Chair, I suppose the head note could revert to the original language. It's still accurate the way it's written. But yeah, you could, on page 1, line 6, reinstate vacation, and it would then be more precise.
Okay, that will be part of this amendment. And then, Mr. Bottern, go ahead.
Madam Chair, I think that takes care of the changes that would be necessary for Senator Tomasoni's amendment the way he wanted
okay.
it.
Okay.
Madam Chair,
you might Senator Tomasoni?
Mr. Bonner, do we need to take two sick leave account out of the one line 1.6 and just say vacation donation account? That is correct. Yeah, on page, this would be to page 1. of the bill. There is another conforming amendment. There are two of them on line 16. The amendment has superseded that. I picked up the amendment while I was in the previous committee and haven't had the chance to completely engross it. I will double check it while we're sitting here, but I think I have everything for the time being. The new paragraph B, I think, takes care of Senator Tomasoni's concern.
And some of the language in the amendment is the same as it is in the bill. It's just reconfigured or repositioned. So what did I say? Senator Olsen moves adoption of the A5 amendment as modified. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and we now have the bill before us. Senator Tomasoni, would you like to explain how your bill would work?
Madam Chair, this bill is a result of some of the problems that my constituents have experienced with the vacation donation account. And what we're trying to do is to make sure that when people exhaust their vacation, their sick leave account, and then can dip into the vacation donation account, that they can do it seamlessly and make sure that it happens as they're expecting it to happen. The bill itself may have caused a couple of problems that I think we fixed in the amendment. I think the amendment is what I agreed to, so it's very close to what I agreed to. I think it's a piece in the value amendment with the department. I think they can handle this without any problem, and I don't think it causes any kind of fiscal note the way it is. And so I believe that everybody agrees that this one's okay.
So, Senator Tomasoni, how would this work if I were an employee? How would I make use of this
Madam Chair,
new
what
provisions?
Happens what happens right now, as I understand it, is that you exhaust your and the department can correct me if I'm wrong, but you exhaust your vacation donation account and your sick leave account, and then some of your and you make notice to the employees that you have an illness that could be a terminal illness or life-threatening illness, and you can't work, or a spouse or a dependent child can't work. That's all part of it, and so you have to quit work as a result of some of their illness or your illness. You let people know that you are going to need more than what you have available in your vacation and sick leave account. And people can donate up to 40 hours according to the bill of their. What happens is that when you exhaust your benefits, you have to apply for these other benefits. And sometimes there's a gap in between. And so what this will do is it will fill in the gap. And it'll also sometimes employees do it wrong, and so they get denied. And so this will give you a chance to explain
it. So that's why the retroactively is in there. Is that right? Okay. Is there are there any questions for Senator Tomasoni? Someone from Finance want to comment on this bill for the policy of it, or anyone else, or Doer, wherever Doer is, out there somewhere?
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, we're taking a pretty big jump from 12 hours to 40 hours, and I don't know if that has much impact or not, because that's what any individual employee can donate, but there's no cap on how long this could go on. If they can collect enough donations, this employee could stay, so to speak, on the payroll as long as they can collect donations. Is that correct,
Senator Tomasoni?
There's a great big administrative packet on that, and I'm not sure if that's correct or not. I would actually have to have the department help me out on that one.
If you could identify yourself once again, appreciate it.
Whoops. Sorry. Senator Roebling, Lori Hansen, Minnesota Management and Budget. Currently, the program is administered through an administrative procedure. And in the administrative procedure, there is a limit of 1,044 hours or a one-year period of time. So the donations do
so
not
how many,
go on
So how many
forever.
Weeks is that?
It's about half a year.
Half a year. Okay. Senator Roebling, anything further?
No, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering about the addition of sick leave because we just had vacation.
Oh, you took it out.
Okay,
yes, we took it out.
I missed that part of it.
That was in the amendment.
Oh, yeah, there it is.
Anyone else? Senator Olsen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Tomasoni, It does say the 1,044 in B, but we just took that out, too. So does the administrative rule then become the rule? Okay.
It's a cleaner way of referring to it, because if the rule got changed, then we'd have a conflict with the statute, et cetera. Anything further for Senator Tomasoni? Anybody else want to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 702 as amended? Seeing none, Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 702 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Tomasoni. Senator Betzel.
We did Box. Madam Chair, did we do Senator Box bill?
Yes.
We did.
Okay. Senator Tomasoni, remember how you were treated in this committee.
I know. And Madam Chair, I had an amendment that pertained to the bill, which is even better. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 191 is actually the vehicle for the omnibus pension bill. And let me just make a few comments. As you and members are aware, we have a House Senate Pensions Commission. The Senate has the gavel for the next 2 years. I am chairing the Pensions Commission. The other senators who are on it include Senator Lynch, Mary Olson, Senator Pappas, and Senator Rosen. And we have been meeting over the past couple of weeks, including on Fridays when this committee was meeting, which is why I was not here on some of your Friday meetings. I've tried to put together a bill that dealt with the issues that had to be dealt with this particular legislative session. There's many other pension issues, frankly, that are going to be pushed off and for the interim for next year's bill. So the bill that you have before you, as thick as it is, represents the work of this year's Pensions Commission. In starting, I would like to comment that members may have been hearing about one particular issue which is not in this bill, and that is the governor's proposal to move some people from the corrections pensions plan into another pension plan. That is not part of this proposal. I'll be happy to, it's not just a pension issue. It's a corrections funding issue. It's a health care issue, collective bargaining issue, but it's not part of this bill. I will briefly go through some of the major components that are in this bill as we review it. And Madam Chair, I'd like to start by offering the DE4 amendment. This is the it's a delete all amendment, and this is the work of the Pensions Commission, which was recommended to be amended on to the carrier bill, which is Senate File 199. So I move the DE4 amendment.
Senator Betzel moves the DE4 amendment. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Okay. The bill is now before us as recommended by the Pension Commission and Senator Betzel.
And Madam Chair, this bill has 13 articles, and you've got a summary in your packets of them. Let me just kind of go through them. No.
Senator Betzel, do you think maybe the ones that are for like individuals, you could kind of skip over deal with the general policy of pensions.
And I intend to do that.
Unless
Madam
someone
Chair.
Has a question about one of those individual provisions.
The first article is just cleanup language. Last year we had a triggering mechanism to merge what's called the active fund, which is the current employees, with the post fund, which is the retired employees. Those are separate funds. We said that if the funding ratio dipped below 85% in 2 years or 80% in 1 year, those two funds would merge. A year ago, we thought it might never happen, and of course, with the stock market dropping, the funding ratios of the major funds did drop below 80%. So this did happen, and so the Article 1 is basically the statutory change that we need to make in order to have that the merger or those two funds. Article 2 deals with disability benefits, and we've actually made it significant.
Senator Betzel, excuse me. Would you prefer that members ask questions?
Oh, sure. I guess
as we're going along, I think that could make the discussion more focused.
So we don't bounce back. Yes, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone who has a question or an issue to raise on Article 1? Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Betzel, I've had a lot of people talking to me about whether their post fund is going to be okay. And what's the details on how this will be, the fund will be balanced out?
Senator Bessel?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Olsen, again, to briefly describe it, and what had happened was people who were active employees made contributions for the employer and the employee into a fund, and the money was invested in the stock market. And we also had some state appropriations for the major funds. Once a person retired, that person's money was transferred out of that active fund into what's called a post fund. When there were no more employer or employee contributions, it's just basically the investments by the stock market. We saw a year ago that down the road there could be some problems in the post funds, and unfortunately, if the post funds are allowed to lose efficiency, if they start losing money, there's no way to make it up without, say, a state appropriation. So that's why we put the triggering mechanism saying that if they started getting down below a certain length, that would merge the two funds. Now, that was controversial because some active employees did not want to take on basically the liabilities of the post fund. On the other hand, there aren't any active employees that want to retire and go into a post fund that is not adequately funded. So either way, you're going to have that deficit sitting there. This was done, again, the triggering mechanism was put into the pension bill last year so that if it did happen, this would basically be able to smooth it out, average everything out, to give more stability to the two funds by merging the active fund with the post fund. Again, that has already happened. So because of it did go below the 80% threshold. And so Article 1 simply has the statutory change that are necessary to conform with what's already happened.
Senator Olsen?
Yes, Madam Chair. So were contribution rates raised then?
No.
Okay. No. Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else on Article 1? Article 2 then?
Madam Chair, we made a number of major changes in recent years for people who qualify for disability. And it was probably too easy for some people to get disability payments, disability retirement. And so we made it more difficult. This kind of revisits some of the issues. It cleans it up. It actually gives a longer period of time for people to file for disability from 18 months, from 180 days to 18 months. We also, the goal was to, instead of to allow people who retired disability to carry them up to their normal retirement age, then their normal pension would have kicked in anyway. Well, there were some issues in dealing with their health care, in transferring, so that it would be so that this provision. So there's a lot of provisions in here, but the key ones allow the disabilities to transfer from disability status to normal retirement age at age 55, mainly to help get their health benefits and so and qualify earlier. As I say, we're just revisiting some issues that we passed a few years ago when we tightened up the criteria for disability retirement. So,
are there any questions on Article 2? Senator Betzel, I don't think I've ever seen the word disabilitant.
It's a pension and actuarial thing. You know, there's a strange world there. In pension world, they have concepts like positive mortality rates, which means a lot of people die. And that's a good thing.
That's a good thing. Disability.
In actuaries and pension rules, yes, it is.
I'm going to use that word.
Positive mortality.
Senator
rates.
Roebling, do you have a question on Article 2?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering about the employer-paid continuing health coverage. So now if they go into the regular retirement program at 55, in the past, did we or did we not have the employer-paid continuing health coverage until they reach Medicare age?
Senator Betzel.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, this is for the State Patrol. Perhaps I should, you know, have Mr. Martin, the Executive Director of the Pensions Commission, provide additional background here. So,
Mr. Martin, if you'd identify members. Yourself, please.
Yes, members. I'm Larry Martin, the Executive Director of the Legislative Commission on Pensions. The commission did quiz our retirement system director and had someone from finance testify that that currently State Patrol officers do receive this disability coverage. If they suffer a duty disability and are determined to be disabled, that they would receive state health insurance. When the program for the continuation of health coverage was revamped last year, apparently it was omitted to the specific references to the State Patrol plan, and that's that we're told this is a technical change, not a substantive change.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
So it isn't costing more money?
Mr. Martin.
Madam Chair, that was the testimony of the State Retirement System and the Finance Department.
Thank you.
Senator Betzel, Article 3.
Article 3 is actually, and it gets back to the issue I just talked about a minute ago about the people in the corrections plan. This just adds one person to the corrections plan because we have a system where we identify people who have 75% contact with inmates or in the Department of Human Services with dangerous patients. It's a fairly minor one, but we are dealing with that whole plan that is discussed about moving people from that plan into other plans. But this just adds one position.
Any
so that's
question
a
on
minor one.
Article 3? Senator Roebling.
Thank you. I find it very curious that we're adding an automotive mechanic to this group of personnel. And then in the next section, we're taking out an automotive mechanic lead. And I just don't understand how this is figured out. And I know the governor had recommended that we remove more employees from this status, and I see we have done a wash and didn't take anybody else out. But I'm just wondering, why would we put an automotive mechanic in and take a lead out?
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, the Pension Commission set up a process years ago to ask the Department of Corrections to basically go through a thorough process and report back to us on the positions that they identified as positions that had 75% or more contact with inmates. We do a similar process with the Department of Human Services. So this was just their report to us this year that there was a position that they actually had vacant. So we recommended to eliminate it, and they identified a person who's an auto mechanic who in that position has 75% of his contact with inmates. And so, as I say, we're just adopting here the recommendation of the Department of Corrections.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
So do we have auto mechanics and prisoners working side by side, or how do they get into that class? Are the inmates working as auto mechanics?
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Absolutely. That's why this individual would qualify to go into the corrections plan, because it does mean early retirement, because, as I say, the plan originally only applied to prison guards. And a number of other professionals, both in corrections and human services, came forward in the 90s and said, we also have regular contact, you know, with these people, and we think that we ought to be able to retire at an early age, because as we get older, these dangerous people who we have regular contact in get younger. So the only way that this would have been approved for this position is this person who works with vehicles also works with inmates more than 75% of his time, direct contact. The person who works back in the records office who never sees the patients or inmates doesn't apply. But the people who have the regular contact, those are the ones that are in the corrections plan.
Article 4.
Article 4 is mainly just technical. It's cleanup language. It's various administrative changes. I don't know. There's one item I would highlight in here, that there was some overpayment by the City of Duluth and the Duluth Airports Authority, and we had to spend some time trying to figure out how that is going to be corrected. Most of it, as I say, is more administrative things that the plans needed from us.
Any questions on Article 4? Article 5.
Article 5 is a provision that was requested by PERA. That is the pension plan for the local government employees. They would like to have a provision to allow people who are at least 62 years old to be able to retire, start drawing their pension, which would be lower than what they would have if they worked there until age 65, and be able to actually come work at least 25% reduction of the previous hours and no more than half time. This actually means that we have some people that it's a cost savings, so that instead of working longer and drawing a bigger pension, they can retire earlier, work less than they are now, but it's going to actually save money for some of those people that, you know, want to take advantage of this program.
Any questions on Article 5?
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling, aren't you on this commission?
No, I should be, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm really curious about this rehiring people who are now eligible for a retirement plan when we don't have enough jobs for other people. And it just it has some concern for me. In a time where we're really in need of employees, I can see where this would be a good thing. But right now, when we have a lot of, where our unemployment rate is extremely high, I don't know that we should feel obligated to hire back somebody who has a pretty healthy income to do a job that somebody else who may not have any income could fill.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Mary Vanek, the director of PERA. This provision was put together at the request of the cities and counties primarily, but also in response to workforce planning issues that, yes, until recently was a greater concern, but still is a concern, that you are losing some highly skilled professionals in these positions and not finding people readily available to replace them. For example, the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association contacted us. They have engineers who are eligible to retire. It is difficult for them to find younger people to replace those folks. So they looked at this provision as an opportunity to keep folks on board at a part-time basis and transfer their knowledge and skills to younger people that are coming in that don't necessarily have the educational background when they're first employed, or that haven't been employed long enough to have the sufficient skill sets. Cities and counties are looking at it as a budgetary tool at this time. They don't want to necessarily lose folks who have certain skill sets, but they know they have to downsize. So this allows people to stay on board and transfer, again, their skill sets to people that will be coming up through the ranks. And these folks can then phase into retirement, collect part of their pension, and not have an interruption in their income. It is limited in our bill, in this bill, to a 2-year window because the PERA board wants to review it and see if it has any financial implications. We've been advised it would not, but we want to verify that. And this is also a program that already exists for state employees, was put in place a couple of years ago. So while I understand your concern, Senator Roebling, it is also limited to the discretion of the employer where it is found that they need to try to be able to retain folks. And it is not actually requiring them to retire and be rehired. They basically can reduce their hours, start collecting their pension with no interruption in their service.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Betzel,
as you can see, it does expire June 30th of 2011. We also do have in law, and one of the things that we want to avoid having are those individuals who retire with a full pension one day and then they come back as a consultant the next day doing the same job and draw the pension and a consultant. That is not good policy. This does not allow that to happen.
Article 6.
Madam Chair, members, Article 6 is a major article in this bill, and there are a number of folks who are here today who have an interest in this one. This deals with the teachers' funds. The main teacher fund in the state is TRA, the Teachers Retirement Association. There's two smaller teacher funds, one in St. Paul and one in Duluth, that are also affected by this. But when I refer to TRA, I'm referring to all three funds. In 2002, TRA and the other funds as well mainly TRA, had a 100% funding sufficiency. As of 2008, TRA was down to 80%, downward trend. Now, again, when you keep in mind where the money comes from, they've got a standing appropriation from the legislature, same money hasn't changed, employer and employee contributions, and the stock market results. Well, it's been going down at a steady rate for the last 6 years. The stock market obviously has accelerated it, but frankly, there's a number of other factors that have caused TRA to go downwards in its funding, and partially is the fact that some people are living longer than expected. That's this positive mortality rate issue again, I guess. But it also, you know, it's – and some people, frankly, probably retired a bit too early. Under the rule of 90, I've commented that if I had gone into teaching and I'm 58 years old today, I'd be retired today. And pensions were never intended to do that. But we do have, you know, a number of stressors on the teacher funds. And we don't want to have the fund keep going on a downward trend – so that it gets to the point where, like Minneapolis teachers was a few years ago, where they're down in the 50% funding range, and we ultimately had to roll them into the TRA fund because there was just no hope of righting that ship. So what this would do is set up a mechanism to basically provide stable funding in the future for the teacher funds. And again, we can't rely upon the stock market alone to do that. Now, obviously, it's going to turn around at some point, but it would have to have phenomenal returns in order to make this, you know, get it right back to 100% funding. So this would require a couple of things here. It would require contribution increases by the employer and the employee. Now, when I say the employer, I mean the school district. So they would have to pay more for their employees, and it's a graduated step up starting in 2012, where every year they would have to increase their contributions by 5%, so that it would be a total of a 2% contribution increase, and you've got a handout showing a graph on that. Now, where are the school districts going to get the money to do that? And that is still a question that we're going to have to be battering around and the Finance Committee, and possibly the Tax Committee. And I don't know how it's all going to play out in the legislature. It is possible there might be levy authority. This bill does not say that, but it's possible that we might have to give the school districts levy authority in order to make their contribution increases. Or they could pull it out of their hide. I can't think of a lot of school districts that are in a position to do that, but that might have to be the decision. The other thing, and this is what this bill currently provides for, and this is an issue for the Finance Committee to deal with, is that this would start, there would be an increase in the state contributions to the pension funds starting with the fiscal year 2012. So this would be an increase, as they say, in state payments, and it would be a graduated payment. I think the first year is like $25 million in addition, and it keeps rising, so it would be, again, under this bill, which, you know, could be changed as we get into the finance part of it. To about, I guess, about a close to about a $230 million total, I think, over about a four-year period. That
Senator,
number can
Senator
change.
Senator Betzel, the goal of this article is to accomplish?
It's to correct a downward trend in funding for the teacher funds, primarily TRA.
Okay. Questions?
And again, doing nothing. Now, I have to finish off where it's going up. The employees would also be paying more. The teachers would also be paying more out of their paychecks to do that. Now, it'd be a little bit of a – it'd be asking quite a bit to say, well, you're going to pay much more, a lot more, out of your paychecks to get the very same benefits that you currently have. So this bill would provide some benefit increases for them for the fact that they are paying more. And it would allow teachers, for instance, with – right now, they have to work to age 66. They could, if they've got 30-year service, they could retire at age 62. They could retire earlier than that, but they get less of a pension. Now, if we were to just have the teacher employee contribution just not included in this, they would not have any benefit increases. They wouldn't have to pay any more, but that still wouldn't solve the problem that we need the employer contributions to help out in funding TRA. We hope this is going to solve the problem, but as I say, this is potentially a huge problem down the road, and we want to address it sooner than later. And so, Madam Chair, I've kind of given you a quick outline over what Article 6 is, but it is a significant part of this bill.
Questions on Article 6? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is giving me heartburn. I sit on the E-12 budget division, and, you know, we tried to put together a balanced bill, but we're also supposed to be looking out into the next biennium. Mm-hmm. And there's no money in there for this, I'm sure, for the school districts to help cover this increased cost and employer contribution. Plus, I suspect that the employees will probably try and make sure that they get a salary increase to help cover their contribution, which would also come out of the school district's budgets. And so we're talking about a pretty significant increase on the taxpayers. And the thought of a special levy for this really gives me heartburn. Through this whole process, you know, we have had a stock market that has been very volatile, and we all know that. And most people who aren't public employees have lost significant amount of money in their retirement accounts. And they're all wondering what they're going to do about that. But we have public employees that have that defined benefit that they think and believe they'll always get the, you know, a certain amount that is going to go up every year with the consumer price index or better. So did the commission look at all at reducing the defined benefit instead of just increasing the input? I'm just troubled by this because we have all these people who are private employees who aren't going to get any kind of a backfilling like this that they probably need worse than this fund right here. I mean, some of their funds are down to 60%, and I just don't want to hit them again with a tax increase to cover this, so that some people have no reduction at all, and everything goes on, you know, just like hunky dory, everything's fine. We don't have to expect anything bad to happen to our retirement plan, because we're public employees.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, first of all, I anticipate that this article in this bill will come before the E-12 budget division. So when it goes to the Finance Committee, I am sure that the members of that budget division are going to want to know all this, and we're going to have a very full discussion about it. There really is no way you can retroactively change current benefits. I mean, if somebody is under a defined benefit plan right now, that's basically what they're going to get. I mean, you can apply future employees to change that around to defined contribution. But there is no way you can back up right now and switch them over into a different benefit structure. So we did not really get into that issue. And frankly, defined benefits and defined contributions both have their upsides and downsides. The downside with defined contribution is that if the stock market goes bad, as it has been, your contribution can go down, which I think every legislator elected since 1996 is in a defined contribution plan. And those, like myself, who elected to go in there, are there too. So there are a lot of employees who are a little bit nervous when they get their defined contribution statements because of the stock market. Now, good times, it goes up. But, no, we did not, to answer your question, no, we did not see that as an option because there wasn't much we could do right now with the way it's set up.
Mr. Madam Chair?
Senator Roebling.
I guess I'm in the St. Paul one now. But what is the cap? In the past, and we did this to the other funds, and I'm not sure if we did it to the teachers, but I know we did it to the PERA. When the times are good, what has been the traditional payout for TRA? So are they capped at
COLA?
The COLA or, you know, where are they?
Yeah, Mr. Martin, I think.
Mr. Martin?
Yeah. Members, I think that the senator is asking about post-retirement increases. Since 2006, legislation has imposed on the post-retirement fund and now the pension funds unseparated a 2.5% cap on their consumer price index driven cost of living increase, and now it's a 2.5% post retirement increase unconnected to the cost of living.
And Madam Chair, Senator Roebling,
Senator Betzel,
the reason why we did that was because in the 90s, when the economy was going well, the stock markets were doing well, the returns were well, of course, there was a lot of pressure on the legislature to increase cost of living increases because they said, well, we've been eaten by inflation, things are tight, but it's bad policy to just provide increases when the times are good and no increases when the times are bad. You should have enough money to be able to smooth it out. So if you have good times, that you may be able to have the more money for greater increases. We still had it capped, saying you can't go beyond that 2.5%. So that, we did it when things were going on the downside, but that is law now that we cannot, overpay the benefits regardless of how the stock market is doing.
Further questions on Article 6? Article 7.
Article 7 deals with Minsky. And there's an early retirement incentive program, cash incentives and employer contributions, or the combination of them, and which would sunset after 5 years. This is, as I say, an early retirement opportunity for them as well, too. And I believe we have maybe some people here who may be able to discuss that if that's the desire of the committee.
Are there questions on Article 7?
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I'm wondering about this offer of post-retirement health savings plan or something similar. I know that some of our pension funds that have combined health benefits with early retirement have run into significant financial trouble because of the escalating costs of the health care. And I'm just wondering if this is set up any differently so that we don't run into that same problem if this is offered for an early retirement program.
Senator Betzel.
This goes into an IRA account. So these are the contributions that they make into those retirement, the IRA account, which is separate from that issue.
Article 8.
Madam Chair, Article 8 deals specifically with the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Association. 2 years ago, they were also in a downward trend. They were set up paying too many cost of living increased benefits that could not be justified. So we put a 2-year pilot project in place to try to rein in some of the costs there. This modifies that. They still cap their annual post-retirement mechanisms. So we basically have another 2 years to try to help that. Of the three pension funds, actually, this is in somewhat worse shape than the other two. So this one is one we're monitoring quite closely. But as I say, this just kind of refined the 2-year pilot program that we had to try to help that particular fund.
Question, Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, with this pilot program, we're actually trying to divorce the COLA from how the markets are doing. That's been the problem in the past, and just tie it more to what a real cost of living increase is. So the cost of living, I think, over the last 2 years was like 1.8%. That was the COLA. And it because they didn't go up to the 2.5 or higher, they saved about $40 million. So we hope that during the next 2 years, by keeping it tied to the consumer price index or whatever it's tied to, the consumer price index, it also will restrain the COLA.
Senator Roebling.
I appreciate that explanation. I'm just wondering, I think our other ones are capped at 2.5% annually right now, and this one says it's capped at 5% annually, so if inflation or the COLA would go up significantly, it would go up to 5% instead of 2.5%.
Senator Betzel, Senator...
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Roebling. That's true, but unlikely. And this is, again, a two-year pilot that we're experimenting, you know, which we didn't want to have no cap, so we kept the 5% cap. And there might occasionally be times if we would look out, you know, 10 years or something, where it would go above the 2.5%, but it's mostly going to stay right around that number.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling?
I'm just wondering, you know, for equity, why we wouldn't put 2.5 on that fund as well as the other ones that are in place. I mean, it is unlikely maybe in the next 2 years, although I kind of am expecting a rush of inflation here coming on. I think a lot of economists maybe too. And it could jump up. And, you know, it's an inequitable situation because the other ones are capped at 2.5.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, it's a different model. The other ones are capped at 2.5, but that's higher than the rate of inflation right now. So by sticking to the rate of inflation, we're going to come in well under the 2.5. And sometimes it might be 2.6% or 2.7%. But it would be unfair to when the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Association is in years when inflation is below 2.5%, to not allow them to also, when inflation is above 2.5%, to go above, because it's tied to cost of living and divorced from how the market's doing. And that's one of our principles in the Pension Commission, is to preserve the buying power of the pension.
Article 9?
Article 9 is actually a local provision for the Fairmont Police Relief Association, okay. by Senator Rosen. It just extends her amortization date.
Or Article 10?
Article 10 deals with the work it's been going on for a few years to try to this is a voluntary program for a statewide firefighter plan. We have like about some 800 different local plans out there. A lot of these local individuals are doing a lousy job. Some do a very good job of managing it, but frankly, we're trying to set up a situation where these local plans can get out of the paperwork, put their money with the State Board of Investment, and have it managed there instead of having these local plans. A lot of local areas want to have the control over their pension plans, but some don't do a very good job of managing them. And so this is not forcing anybody into a statewide plan that doesn't want to be. I can foresee a day when we may take the underperformers and say, you got to move in. But this is simply voluntary because there's a lot of these local organizations that would like to get out of managing these funds, and this is the statewide plan to do it.
Any questions on Article 10? Article 11.
Article 11, Madam Chair, deals with just a number of provisions statewide with local firefighter groups. There was a volunteer working group that put together most of the proposals in here. I think there's nothing out that really jumps out at me that is really, you know, significant from a policy standpoint. But as I say, these are just things to tighten up, you know, how they do things as a result of. And a lot of these recommendations, by the way, came from the state auditor's working group, because she has a strong interest in how the pension funds are working. And so she's been working with these groups to come up with their recommendations. And these basically came out of, you know, her working group.
Article 12?
Article 12 is simply drafting errors, cleaning up technical problems that we found within the past bills. There's nothing significant or even interesting in any of them. So.
Okay, and Article 13, you already explained.
And those were just local provisions by Senator Scogin, Senator Wieger, Senator Bach, Senator Hahn.
Okay, are there overall questions for Senator Betzel from members? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak in opposition to any one of the articles? Opposition. You could identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Mark Haven. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Taxpayers Association. We oppose Article 6, which is the benefit package increase for the Teachers Retirement Association. We see several public policy problems associated with this provision. First of all, the scheduled contribution increases that you have before you are insufficient to pay for both the restoration of fund health as well as the benefit increase. This is an issue that's been flagged by the commission staff as well in their memo to the LCPR. Secondly, I think it's important to note that the condition of the fund has deteriorated since the last actuarial evaluation. It has been noted here before at 80% funded ratio approximately, but that was as of June of 2008. Since that time, markets have deteriorated rapidly, and it's very likely that the future actuarial evaluation will trigger a contribution deficiency finding that will result in all of these contribution increases that were proposed before you just to be needed to restore the health of the fund, let alone a benefit increase. Thirdly, we believe the idea that has been promulgated by advocates of this plan that the employees are paying for their own benefits under this package is simply not correct for this reason. Pension contributions are fungible. The State Board of Investment does not segregate money coming from employees versus that coming from employers, nor does it separate money going to an existing benefit package to going to a new benefit package. Because of this, the accurate way to describe this provision is that state taxpayers and public employees are sharing equally in an inadequate attempt to fund existing and new retirement benefits. We also question the rationale for a benefit increase for teachers. The 2008 report from the three major state retirement systems conclude that Minnesota plans, combined with Social Security benefits and modest levels of personal savings, provide a satisfactory level of economic resources for public employees who retire at the normal ages of 65 and 66. And we would argue strongly that the determination of adequacy for teacher benefits should be based on standards of replacement income, not the lobbying efforts of other states. We are also concerned about the two-year delay in implementation to address fund health. We think a strong case can be made that prudent financial practice here would dictate that some of these contributions should be made now to take advantage of depressed market conditions. And certainly we believe that any discussion of benefit increases should be postponed until 2011, when hopefully we have much greater clarity with respect to the economic conditions we're facing and a better understanding of where we are and what we're able to pay in the future. Finally, we're also concerned about the inequity issues that arise as a result of this provision among all types of employees, public employees, and the lobbying pressures that will result. The difference between a 2.1% multiplier, as contained in this bill, and the 1.7% multiplier applicable to the general plans of MSRS and PIRA is a very significant difference, and it's a near certainty that in the future this will become a major issue before you as equity issues again arise. In conclusion, we believe that this is not a time to be talking about benefit increases. Fixing the existing problem and ensuring the problem doesn't get worse should certainly be the sole focus for action at this time. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak in opposition to any section of this bill, any article? Do members have any amendments? Seeing none, Senator Betzel moves that Senate file, whatever it is,
191,
as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All who are in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members?
Members, although it may be the case that we will have other hearings if something special comes up, this is the last regular hearing of this committee, and I hope you will join me in thanking our staff, the committee staff, the Page, our interns, the partisan staff that advises the Republicans, and ourselves. So if you'll join me.
Thank you.
There we go.
I have enjoyed this, and we'll see you again, and thank you for being such great committee members. We stand adjourned.